This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to talk with a local author, doesn't live here anymore, but she's from here, that's Sarah Coomer, and she has a new book, The Same Moon. It's a memoir, and joining me in studio is Ashley Thornburg with Sarah. We're going to talk about the book and the experience that is behind it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. The book stems from several experiences living in Japan, both as a high school exchange student, and then later you went back after some troubled times. It took a little while to get it all down on paper. Why did you want to write this book?
That's a great question. It didn't really start off as, oh, I'm going to sit down and write this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it started off as, oh, I need to finish the master's degree that I ran away from because I just didn't have it in me to do a thesis or a project at that time. So I, you know, started doing a series of essays that ended up helping me finish my degree. And then I remember when I was defending it, my advisor said, you should turn this into a book. I thought, wow, huh, okay. And then life happened, and so much happened, and it wasn't until I was in another grad program where I needed some material, and I kind of went back and plumbed the depths of my high school experience and actually pursued that and wrote that halfway into a whole different direction and set it aside again. And finally, I just thought, you know, I have something to say. I want to talk about hope, and I want to talk about not just my own personal experience of figuring things out or finding a way out in order to figure things out, but also the idea that we get to know other cultures slowly, one story at a time. And that can be whether we're talking about intercultural like Japan or, you know, Ukraine or wherever, but even within our own country, there are so many different cultures, politically, ethnically, socioeconomically, and the only way we can get to know that is really sitting down together, one story at a time.
Well, this book actually starts with your experiences about 30 years ago. Let's talk about the title, the significance of that, The Same Moon.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in Japan as a 16-year-old, I had this great opportunity to be the first exchange student in this little town that I was in. And so I got to meet everybody, and people were not shy about coming up to me and, you know, getting to know me a bit. And I met a lot of students. I went to high school there for a couple of weeks because they go to school into July it was. And one of the students that I met, you know, I kind of had a little crush on, and it seemed to be mutual. And before I was leaving, we were on a walk with my host family, and we were just talking about, like, oh, you know, it's sad to be leaving. And he said, yeah, but look at this, you know, look at the moon. And, you know, when you go back to the States, you can look at the moon. And when I'm here, I can look at the moon and I'll think of you. It's the same moon.
Mm.
And, you know, that kind of, that stuck with me, obviously. And at the time, it was just like, oh, yeah, it's this person and me. But then I've started realizing, like, oh, the same moon is just over all of us every night. Well, and every day. And, it's just a way to kind of think of how we're all in this together.
Yeah. It's a call to look for similarities more than differences.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love what you said about you had to go back and mine your high school to get through this next level education thing. And there's this silly little joke in French that, like, if you ask a French person the impacts of the French Revolution, they'll say, well, we're still figuring that out. And that's back in the 1700s.
Wow.
But when you talk about being an exchange student in high school, you're still feeling the effects of that.
Yes.
Decades later.
Yes. Absolutely.
How much of that did you realize while you were writing the book?
Oh, I don't know if I was processing that so much as I was writing it.
Okay.
'Cause it's just like my life. I'm just writing my life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of more since I finished the book and have set it aside and have been processing, like, how do I talk about this project, right, this book? And really thinking that summer really reoriented my life. And I think I say in the book that I didn't even think about going to Japan. I wanted to go to Germany.
Mm.
You know, that was my goal. And my guidance counselor at Oak Grove Lutheran High School, you know, Alice Underbakke, she could see that I just was really eager for an experience like this. But my parents said, you know, a year is too long for you to go. And that was the program I was looking at. She's like, but get this. There's this program to Japan. It's just a summer, you know. And that conversation changed my life. So Japan is so much a part of me. And I have people in Japan that I'm a part of their lives. Mm-hmm. And, like, that'll never end.
Well, you talk about the relationships you had with a boy and a man, two different Japanese people, and also learning to play the Japanese zither, mm-hmm. Learning a language, mm-hmm. and a very different culture in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'd like to say it came about largely because of the family that I was in there. I was in this three-generation home, and there was a grandmother, two host sisters, and my host parents. And my host sister that was my age, she could function a bit in English, and then she went on to function marvelously now. But like my host grandma, she hardly spoke a word. And I really just wanted to come back and learn Japanese myself so I could go back and talk to her. You know, so it was that love that we kind of developed there.
Okay, well, let's get a sense of the book, because early in the book you talk about wanting to fit in, because here you are, a very tall woman by the cultural standards of the people you're standing among. You're much taller than they are. Talk about trying to kind of assimilate.
So this is part of how I describe that. The star power I experienced at the beginning of my time in Shuhocho eclipsed even that of 8 years earlier when I arrived in Hagi as its first international exchange student. My strategy then, as a high school student, was to try and blend in with my host sister Miho's high school classmates. Despite my hair, my eyes, and the height that made me nearly a head taller than most of the girls my age, and many of the boys as well, working my peripheral vision to the hilt, I had followed the lead of those around me, studying how to eat properly, walk properly, listen properly, and dress properly, trying to avoid attracting attention based on attributes I could control. I came to favor skirts over shorts, covered my broad smile with the palm of my hand, raised my voice to a higher register, and tied a ribbon around my ponytail at the, quote, golden point on the crown of my head. I evolved something of a Japanese persona, one of which I only became aware on my few encounters that summer with other foreigners. In fact, I tried so hard to fit in that when I was out in public and happened to catch my own reflection in a mirror or pane of glass, I was startled to see my small face, ivory skin, and sky-colored eyes on a head of wavy brown hair. I looked strange, even to myself.
That's so darling. Well, and that universal theme, though, of trying to fit in mm-hmm. in high school. And the word that sticks out to me most in that entire passage is properly, because that's so relative.
Right.
So just let's just talk about when you say how to walk properly. What does that mean?
You know, a lot of it is about taking up less space. I think, especially here in the Northern Great Plains, we've got a lot of room. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can kind of walk big. You swing your arms and maybe, you know, your feet might go out a little bit. And what I observed there, I'll never forget, just noticing how a lot of the girls kind of walked a little bit pigeon-toed, just slightly pigeon-toed, some more pigeon-toed. And their feet were definitely like very together. And it was just kind of demure. And sometimes you kind of had this slant to you as if you're leaning into a prairie wind, you know. You're just kind of slanted a little bit. And you're just – the sense is of trying not to take up too much space. And so I really tried to take up less space.
Well, you have a crush on a Japanese boy, Ryota, mm-hmm. and that eventually you part ways because you come back to the U.S. You get married. The marriage doesn't last very long. Mm-hmm. You go back to Japan to teach English. You meet a fellow by the name of Hideo. These relationships wind their way all the way through the book.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd be lying if I said that these relationships aren't a big part of why I stayed connected to Japan, you know? I mean, I think that that interest and that curiosity about what is this like in another culture, you know, what is it like to have a relationship and have that level of closeness? And really, it's thanks largely to Hideo that, he really helped me get past the difficulties of the previous few years, like with going through a divorce at a young age. And he really gave me perspective on that and showed me that I was okay in the end. And B, he introduced me to so much about Japanese culture and just the conversations we got to have and to be able to ask questions, you know, to say, why do people do this? Or why did my teacher say this? Or why, you know, I had so many why questions over there. And you can't just ask that to casual friends, you know? Mm-hmm. So he helped me really to go deeper into the culture.
When you talk to people, because you've experienced both of these cultures rather intimately, obviously you grew up in America and you were back and forth to Japan, how would you contrast, how would you describe the differences to people? I know there are similarities.
Yeah, I was about to say, the similarities are easier to say than the differences in a way. But the differences, and I feel like I'm kind of saying something that's canned, but you know, there in Japan, there's that group orientation. And I just think I really felt that so strongly there, where you're part of this group and you kind of answer to the group, like your worker group or your club group. And I felt that much more strongly than I've ever felt in a work group or a club group or, you know.
When you were teaching, you actually lived in the cement company's apartment building.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
With other cement company workers.
That's right. Yeah. It was unusual.
I'll say.
It was really an unusual situation. And the only reason that I was there in that building was because it was the only rentable place in that small town of like 7,000 people that had a Western-style toilet. And they really wanted to make sure I had something comfortable. So that's how I ended up there. But I was very aware there of how they were definitely like working together to have like a common face to the community. Mm-hmm. And they were very responsible to each other.
Yeah. Well, there's a stress of the collective over the individual. And Western society is very much stressing individual accomplishment and individual achievement.
Yes.
I guess those are kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
One thing that stuck out to me in reading about the process of writing the book and just the process of being an exchange student is gender roles. And I'm really fascinated by what you were saying about how you viewed women there and young girls and then how that impacted the way that you taught in your classes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I grew up largely in the 80s, and I think that the message I really got is you can do anything. You know, you're a woman, you can just do anything. Just, you know, keep your focus and keep at it. And when I got there, and, you know, bear in mind, this was in the mid-90s, and this was a very small town. It was very traditional there, and the traditionals run really deep. Mm-hmm. And what I experienced right away was seeing that the women were still expected to serve tea and coffee and that sort of thing. And it quickly became apparent that it'd be best for me to do that too. And it was serving tea and coffee to the men who would hang out.
Yowza.
Right? It was just different. And I finally had to just like say, okay, this is where I'm at when in Rome, right? So we did that. But it also made me see that this is what my students, these middle school students, were observing all the time as well. And I kept thinking, I want them to have that same sense that I grew up with, that they can do anything. And so, you know, I couldn't do much because I was a short timer, just there for 2 years. And I didn't have authority, really, to do anything. But my strategy was then, like in English classes, you're always giving sample sentences for people to repeat back and that sort of thing. And I would always make sure that the doctor was a female character or the astronaut or the, you know, whatever. And, you know, I'd empower the boys too. But mostly I was like, you know, that shy girl over there, I'm going to make her say something that would be a wonderful dream for her to have, you know, try and kind of plant seeds. And I've, you know, it's been enough time that I've really lost track. I don't know much about what happened. But I do know one of my students who was this lovely girl, just a great student, and so sweet and kind. And she had a dream of becoming an astronaut. And I was so excited for her. And I went back a few years later and walked into my school and turned out she'd become a teacher there,
aww,
which was awesome as well. And she just seemed so pleased that she had achieved this. And so, yeah.
You were an English teacher there, mm-hmm, and the Japanese educational system is different than the American system. But it seems that what you were teaching was a very important subject in that country and in that village.
Yes. Yeah, it really was. For high school entrance exams are a very big deal. That really determines a lot of your future. At least it did at that time. You know, I haven't been back for a few years now. But English is a major topic on there. And traditionally, English has been taught very much like grammatically based and vocabulary. And so they were really good at grammar and vocabulary. But most of the time, students couldn't speak it.
Conversationally, they were impaired.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Impaired maybe by their depths of knowledge on what most of us don't have. Yeah, so what they really did with this program, the JET program, Japan Exchange and Teaching, which has been going on now since like 87, is they really wanted us to come in there and help make conversation possible for these students, applied English. So that was my role.
And you pick up the Japanese zither, this device, it's called a koto?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you still play it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was a pretty serious piano student as a young person through college. And when I got there, you know, I did a little piano. I would grab a piano and then just play a little bit. But it was one of my first weeks there, my boss's wife, she was taking the zither lessons or koto lessons. And my boss said, hey, you know, come follow me. I went up there. And that teacher, I mean, as soon as I walked in the door, she just was like, ha ha, we've got one here. And so she brought me in. And within 2 weeks, they had me on a stage playing at this international concert, which was a complete nightmare. It was like one of those nightmare dreams, you know? But I got hooked. I love the zither, and I was fortunate enough to take 10 more years of it in Portland with a teacher there. So,
just very quickly, because we don't have much time left, but the role of, and I'm using air quotes, failure in your life, where you talk about going to Japan again after a failed marriage and not getting your dream job, but on the airplane meeting a publisher. So just advice for anyone who is in that, what they feel like, failure stage.
Yeah. And the publisher I met, to be fair, he is not the one that picked this up.
Right.
But he actually changed my writing and helped me bring in faith into it, mm-hmm. which I think actually made the book stronger and maybe helped get it published finally. But the thing is just to keep going, you know. And I have to say, on the way over here, I saw a lost dog sign. And it said, lost dog, do not chase. I saw another sign like that recently in Washington State. I'm like, huh, interesting. And it just hit me like, you know, sometimes we have these big dreams and you feel like, I got to just muscle through. I got to just get it. I got to keep going, go, go, go. And I think sometimes the important thing is do not chase. Like, just wait a little bit because there might be something that's coming that'll make it make more sense and that'll actually make it come true.
Sarah Coomber is the author of The Same Moon, published by Touchpoint Press, and she'll be appearing at Zanbro's in downtown Fargo later this week, Thursday evening at 6:30. It's free and open to the public, and thank you very much for spending some time on Main Street today.
Thank you. Domo arigato gozaimasu.
Coming up on Main Street, more conversation from the Antiques Roadshow stop at Bonanzaville.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Easter Seals Goodwill ND Inc., providing support for children, adults, and families in need across North Dakota, thanks to donated goods at their Goodwill retail stores. Learn more at esgwnd.org, because a better community starts with you.
More than 60,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized in the 20th century. How did this happen?
You got rid of the plant that was rotting in the field. You weeded your garden so as to get rid of the kinds of organisms that would ruin the whole plot.
Stories of lives forever changed by the American eugenics movement, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Antiques Roadshow was a Prairie Public television favorite on Monday evenings. Sometime next year, West Fargo's Bonanzaville will be the location for 3 of the shows. In June, thousands of hopefuls flooded Bonanzaville to take advantage of the respected appraisers who travel with the show, and our Bill Thomas mingled with the crowd and talked with several people about the experience and the family treasures they brought with them.
My name is Laura. I'm from DeWitt, Michigan.
So how'd you get here? You drove down?
I drove down. It's a good way to spend time with friends and rent a car.
Yeah, spend a little time in Fargo while you're here.
Yeah, we stayed overnight. We're going to stay another day here and then head out to Mount Rushmore and check that out.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of people who are bringing Mount Rushmore into the loop.
Oh, nice. And I hear Bismarck is pretty, too. Going to go check out your capital because I'm from a capital city, too.
What did you bring?
I brought a mid-century modern tray that's really funky colors and a set of silverware that the writing on it's in German. It's from Germany, I was told, from about 150 years ago. Has the punch bowl ladle and the whole bit.
So did you just find that out today?
No, I actually haven't gone through the lines yet.
Oh, you haven't gone through yet, huh?
I wanted to come play with you guys first.
Sure, sure. So you could still find out something really exciting.
I just might if you hear me do a big whoop.
Okay. And have you got a lot of stuff, or was it hard to pick things to bring?
It was really hard. I have a lot of funky things. I'm a hoarder of good stuff. I have some fun stuff, but this year I decided to bring something that wasn't art.
So have you been before?
Yes, this is my fourth time.
Wow. You must have a lot of stuff.
I do. I have an antique shop, too, where I set up things that are mid-century, modern, retro, and funky stuff back in Lansing.
And I would say you're lucky to get in four times.
I am very lucky. I don't know how it keeps happening, but I'm so glad.
Have you seen Roadshow evolve a little bit, as you've obviously followed it for a while?
Yes, it really has changed. I like the different venues they're choosing and getting to different parts of the Americas, and getting different regional things is interesting to watch, too.
Christine from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Zachary from Winnipeg.
Cleo from Winnipeg.
So are you fans of the show?
Oh, forever. I watch the show, and it's great family program. My son can watch it. Then we play a little game. How much is it? So he'll say it's $500, and I'll say, oh, I think it's more, maybe $1,000. And it's $5,000. So it's good family entertainment for everybody.
So what did you bring for the show?
I bring the picture. That's all. Just my picture.
And how much was the picture, Mom?
Was it 100?
Yeah.
Yes, it was $100. So yes, yeah.
And I brought in a clock that's about 110 years old from Germany, and it was about $100 also, and a Lalique statue, which was appraised at $500. So I am happy, but I'm not going to sell anything. I'm going to keep it.
Uh-huh. So it's worth coming down from Winnipeg?
Oh, yeah. The weather is amazing. We love our neighbors. We love Fargo. And everybody in the Antiques Roadshow has been very friendly and helpful. And it's fun. It's great to meet new people like yourself, Bill.
So did you find out new information about the things you brought that you didn't know before?
Yeah, that it's valuable. I was expecting that, oh, you know, it's, you know, $20 or whatever. But to hear one of the pieces was $500 was really very surprising. And I'll make sure we package it up properly so nothing gets broken. And now when we have company coming over to the house, we can say there's the Lalique from great-grandma, and it will stay in the family.
Our director of radio, Bill Thomas, talking with participants at last month's Antiques Roadshow stop at Bonanzaville in West Fargo. In 2015, the show came to Bismarck, and you can see what that looked like this evening on Prairie Public's television service at 7 Central. Coming up on Main Street, Mark Trahant offers a commentary about the service of the former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. And North Dakota native Ilona Peterson and Athena Grasek drop by to talk about Peterson's annual Winds of Change chamber music tour with her New York Kammermusiker. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The shutdown of a Philadelphia oil refinery could have some impact on Bakken crude. A fire severely damaged Philadelphia Energy Solutions, a 335,000-barrel-a-day refinery. After the fire, the company said it was shuttering the 150-year-old plant. It was taking Bakken crude by rail.
Crude oil that was going to that refinery by rail is now going to have to find another export.
North Dakota Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms.
It may have to go to the Gulf Coast by rail, which offers a lower price in the neighborhood of $3 or $4, or it may have to try to get to the West Coast, But again, we have the situation with the state of Washington. So overall, it could result in lower oil prices for North Dakota producers of $3 or $4 on about 20 to 25% of our crude oil production. So a small decrease, but certainly a negative.
School board members from around the state gathered in Bismarck Monday to learn about some of the procedures and issues in education as they prepare for the fall semester. They also heard some of the similarities and differences in the issues each school board faces. For Stanley board member Shane Adnes, the issue in his district is how to handle growth.
We actually have more kids right now than we had during the oil boom. We just completed one more expansion project on the high school that we funded through the state. It failed a vote the first time, and we didn't take it back. We just found another way to do it. We added on to our high school more classrooms, bigger cafeteria, and locker rooms.
Sonia Hansana has been a school board member from Beulah. Her district's main issue?
Getting teachers and retaining teachers. It still seems to be a problem with us with the cuts and things like that. Our money is tight. And to attract them and get them to stay. We get new teachers and they're there for a year and then they move on.
Hansana says she says the key to retaining teachers is to have a competitive salary and benefit package and to allow teachers to be innovative in the classroom. And North Dakota's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate in June came in at 2.3%. That's equal to the May rate and 3/10 lower than 1 year ago. Job service officials say a total of 9,517 North Dakotans were in search of work in June. The latest report shows 20 of 53 counties reported unemployment rates below the statewide average. The non-seasonally adjusted rate for the Fargo metro area in May, the latest month available, was 2.1%. Grand Forks came in at 2.5%, and Bismarck sits at 2.2%. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. The body of former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is lying in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. His funeral will take place tomorrow. Stevens retired in 2010, and he died last week at the age of 99. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today, and he offers a commentary about the importance of an independent judiciary and decisions from Justice Stevens that affected Native Americans.
John Paul Stevens joined the Supreme Court as a conservative member appointed by President Gerald Ford. It's fair to say that many of his early opinions were not favorable to tribal interests. Yet when Stevens retired as a justice, he was known as a leader of the liberal bloc and as a justice who often supported the rights of tribes. Stevens' story is about the independence of the judiciary. He was the third longest serving justice in U.S. Supreme Court history. He died last week. Matthew L. M. Fletcher in the Turtle Talk legal blog wrote that when Stevens retired in 2010, he, generally speaking, favored tribal interests in treaty rights cases and statutory interpretation cases, but was a serious opponent in tribal immunity and taxation cases. Perhaps most significant was Stevens' involvement in the 1979 Bolt decision, or United States versus Washington. The Supreme Court did not review the Bolt case because it denied the state of Washington's appeal from the U.S. Ninth Circuit. But Washington would not give up, and it refused to enforce the court's order. That brought the matter back to the Supreme Court, where it mostly affirmed Judge George Bolt's 1974 decision. The state Supreme Court had ruled that the Fisheries Department need now comply with federal law, and that treaties did not give the Indians a right to a share of the fish runs. Stevens disagreed. He wrote for the majority that tribes have a right, secured by treaty, to take a fair share of the available fish. Stevens called treaties essentially a contract between two sovereigns, and, quote, when Indians are involved, the treaty therefore must be construed not according to the technical meaning of the words of learned lawyers, but in the sense in which they would naturally be understood by the Indians. The message that the Supreme Court sent to Washington was clear and unequivocal. Billy Frank Nisqually often said that that decision saved salmon in the Pacific Northwest because it made tribes co-managers of a scarce natural resource. And tribal governments spent the decades that followed putting resources into science, habitat, and sound management of salmon. However, Stevens ruled against tribes on the issue of taxation. In a 1989 case, Cotton Petroleum Corporation versus New Mexico, the court held that a state and tribe may impose a tax for oil and gas production. Indian Country Today columnist Steve Russell called this one of the dumbest decisions ever in a 2015 essay. Even on the Supreme Court, things change. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Next on Main Street, the annual Winds of Change Chamber Music Tour.
Dakota Date Book finally has a book, and we're going to launch it, quite literally, with a sunset riverboat cruise. Join Prairie Public aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat. We'll set sail from Bismarck Saturday, August 24th at 8 p.m. You'll be first to be able to get your hands and lay eyes on this treasure trove of North Dakota history. The Dakota Date Book book, prepared by a University of North Dakota practicum and the UND Digital Press, features specially selected date books for each day of the year. So practice your best meadowlark whistle. That was good. And get aboard the Lewis and Clark with Dakota Date Book founder Bill Thomas and State Historical Society Director Claudia Burr. Saturday, August 24th, we'll set sail at 8 p.m. Central. Tickets are $15 in advance, $20 at the dock. Go to prairiepublic.org to reserve yours now and to place an advance order of Dakota Date Book North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public. Or you can call 800-241-6900. So sail the majestic Missouri with Prairie Public and celebrate a collection as unique as the state whose stories it tells.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by a familiar voice to those people who listen to Main Street through the years, because every year Alona Peterson joins us. She's the director, the founder of the New York Comer Musicer, a Double Reed music group, right, Alona?
Double Reed Instruments, yes. Uh-huh.
And with you is Athena Grasick. We're calling her the road manager for what will be the 13th annual Winds of Change tour in early August.
Yep, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's get right into it, because you've been doing this a long time, Alona. This is your 50th year.
50th anniversary, that's correct.
You started this in 1969.
That's right.
Well, why?
Why? Well, I mean, we're really fortunate that, you know, it seems like a very short time, these 50 years. We started not as a Double Reed group. We began as strings and winds and then just wind octets. And, you know, gradually it went down to our interest in the repertoire of, and the repertoire fits the Double Reed instruments so well. We have, I think, actually, the Double Reed instruments are the closest to choirs or choruses, that type of, and we started using some of the choral works and put arranging them for our instruments, and we're still doing this. We're doing, a big part of our life is music research, and we just continue day after day. I think you could live a couple of lifetimes and find more and more music that works very well.
How many people participate in the Comer Musicer group? How many people are
Well,
there?
We have probably at the moment, but it's hard to say, 35 people. Most of our musicians are not in this country. Some are in Europe, some are in South America, and of course most of them in this country are in New York City, but we have one from Minneapolis that's been coming out here, and we have our newest English horn player that came last year because I wasn't sure I could make it, but he's going to be back this year. He's from Washington.
So how many people are on the tour, Athena?
On this tour?
Yes.
And this is going to be very interesting because it's our 50th year and everyone wants to come to North Dakota. We will see. I think that we're going to have about 10 maybe 12 Double Reed players. We'll have to put a limit on it soon.
Athena, you are the road manager, and what drew you to, become the roadie for the New York Comer Musicer?
Well, I originally just went just to hear this group. I was working with a symphony, and we were helping them with a concert, and so I thought, well, I'll hear what these people sound like. I love music. I've been a singer myself, and so I thought, well, great, I'll go hear them. I was blown away because they had a perfect, flawless performance. And I've listened to music, classical music, for years, and I'd never heard a live performance that was perfect. There was not a stinker note anywhere, and the sound of the music was so fulsome. It sounds like what it would have sounded like if you were in the Renaissance or the Middle Ages listening to music. And that just spoke to me. So I wanted to help them come back.
It fills the room, I take it.
It does. Even without any kind of amplification, the music surrounds you. It kind of gets into your bones. And their intonation is perfect. Their dynamics are amazing. The softs are the sound that they need to be, and the louds combined together. You can still hear the separate instruments. I've heard them practice, and the flawlessness doesn't come easily. They work at it, and so to present a flawless performance is incredible. It's a great thing to hear.
Well, you've produced CDs, Eloda, and we've got a couple of samples we're going to share with our listeners today. The first one is from a Renaissance tour of Europe, and this was produced in 1990. Introduce this piece called Courante.
Okay, it's by a composer called Scheidt, and he was born in Halle, which was in East Germany at one time, but that's also where Handel was born. Ah. So that's it. His dates are 1587 to 1654.
Well, let's listen. Well, that is a bouncy tune.
Thank you.
And very precise, as Athena said. I mean, it's very...
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's why all my musicians want to play with us, is because we feel a very personal touch, and we get to, you know, decide how we want to play. We don't have a conductor. You know, and we do the dynamics, we do whatever we want, but it's a creative process that we all like.
Well, upcoming, the 13th annual Winds of Change tour through parts of North Dakota and Minnesota, and why the title, the name, Winds of Change?
Our first year, we came out to introduce wind turbines. I think that we were responsible for 500 wind turbines after we were here that year. The reason I did this is because we played for Go Green in New York City for wind turbines. And I thought, why are we playing in New York? Why aren't we playing in North Dakota where there's wind?
Uh-huh.
So it sort of just happened. Every year we have another project that we're interested in, we try to put the ideas out.
Now, this year, what would you call the theme of the tour?
Well, the theme really is historic. We're playing in a lot of historic places. In Jamestown, we're in the historic courthouse that was built in 1883, 6 years before North Dakota was a state. And then we are also in the historic opera houses in Madoc. And they've just completed restoring that opera house. And we'll also be down in Ellendale. They're working on their opera house. But we've been there several times, and we have such great audience down there. We can't miss going every year.
So these opera houses are now, going on like 150 years old almost. But they acoustically work
for
you,
huh? Well, acoustics are fabulous. I'm anxious to hear Madoc, because now they tell me it's great. And I'm sure for classical music, it's going to be even greater. The Ellendale, without having it completed, my son was there and he checked out acoustics. He said they've got fantastic acoustics, and they haven't worked on the upstairs yet. But hopefully they can keep it, you know, as they restore it like Madoc did. So it's actually a historic trip this year. We're also looking into music that was played or sung in churches here. And I'm talking about missionaries from the Episcopal or Presbyterian that came out and worked before North Dakota was a state. And we have been able to find some of the old hymnals, and we see, well, for instance, one hymnal's been translated into the Dakota language, and it changes the melodies just a bit. Oh. So we have taken this music and we've arranged it for our instruments. So that's history too.
And Athena, you've devoted some of your time to this as well.
Well, I have. My main work with the New York Comma Musiker is support. So I help with driving them around North Dakota. Mm-hmm. I help with some of their press. I help with feeding them, which is a big job.
Yeah.
It is, you know, musicians. It's a hungry job playing music for 45 minutes. And so, yep.
Well, let's get another sample here. This is from a 1993 CD titled A Baroque Celebration, music by Bach, Handel, Lully, Purcell, and others. And we're going to hear a piece, from Handel's famous Water Music, right?
It's an air, and I believe that this air starts out with the English horns and combines to all of us with percussion, too, on this particular recording.
Here it is. Little Handel, and again, that fulsome sound from a relatively small group, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it doesn't matter if we're playing with four, quartet, or the larger group. It expands.
Now, this upcoming tour, which is in August, early August, will include Scandinavian music, right?
Norwegian, of course. And, you know, we've played Norwegian folk songs. We've arranged them and dances for a group. And we go back to New York and we include them on our concerts there, and they sometimes are the favorite pieces. You know?
Your son, Bjorn, also accompanies you typically in the Winds of Change tour?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And he has a special role this year?
That's back to the historic. We found even more music from the time of Theodore Roosevelt being out in North Dakota, and we've arranged it. And of course, between all our pieces, we always speak, so he'll be doing the history of Theodore Roosevelt's time in North Dakota with some special things that I had never heard.
Well, maybe one day you'll be playing at the new Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora.
Ah, that would be good.
Okay. Now, again, the Winds of Change tour takes place during a week in early August, and you return to these venues, many of them, quite often. I mean, year after year after year, right? You mentioned the opera houses.
Well, let's also mention Wahpeton.
Oh, Chapinkapa Zoo.
This is Tall, the orangutan's fourth year playing with us. And last year he was so excited when we arrived, he knew exactly who we were.
Well, yes. We should remind our listeners who probably just did a double take, an orangutan playing with the New York Kammermusiker. How does that happen? How do you do that?
Well, 4 years ago, I had the idea because he was – I noticed how smart he was. We sort of taught the trainer a few notes on the recorder, and then the trainer worked, and then two of us went to the zoo and worked with him, and he became attached to the group this way. We sort of gradually moved him into the group.
Well, actually, he loves Jeff. The first time they came to the zoo to meet Tall and to play with him, Jeff and Ilona were the only ones there, and Jeff, out of his memory, played at least half an hour just for Tall. Ah. And Tall was entranced. Tall normally would run around his enclosure, but he sat in front of Jeff and he watched him intently the whole time. And the next time we came back the next year, actually, no, it was later in the week. When they came back, Tall watched the other musicians come in. But when Jeff entered, Tall started blowing him kisses. And you could just see the delight in his face. And he sat again and listened intently to the entire concert.
Well, last year, our Ashley Thornburg did a real nice feature around Tall and the New York Comer Musiker. So some of our listeners might remember that. I'll just mention briefly that the tour starts August 7th at the Radisson Hotel.
Yes, definitely. We're starting on the 7th, 5 o'clock. The next day, we're in Ellendale. On the 9th is a big outreach because we'll start in the morning on the Valley News Live, North Dakota Today. And then in the afternoon, we'll be over at the Muscatel Subaru Showroom once again. And then we'll end the day at West Acres Mall. Then we go on to Jamestown, to the courthouse. We'll be doing master classes there, too. And Madoc, the 11th, will be at the Madoc Opera House. But en route, we'll be like a wandering minstrels. We'll stop off at the historic Viking church, 10 miles south of Madoc, to play. And then the big concert, the First Presbyterian Church in Fargo at 7 o'clock on Monday, August 12th. Then the next day, the zoo bus will pick us up and we will go to Wahpeton and we'll do a zoo concert and then an evening concert there.
Well, how is this tour supported? Because, of course,
a major, major work in progress yet. We have had wonderful co-sponsors, and I like to incorporate the businesses and anyone else, you know, in each town, because then they get interested in this music too. So we're getting a lot of help from that end, from businesses and hotels and the music store here in Fargo comes with music stands. Any way they can help us, we'll take it.
50 years after the New York Kammermusiker was initiated by Ilona Petersen, it's still on the road, still creating music, and it's becoming sort of a fixture in the summer for folks in North Dakota.
That's good.
I'll say so. The 13th annual Winds of Change Tour is coming up, and it's the 50th anniversary of the group's founding. If you've never heard chamber music, this is the group to listen to. Ilona, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Athena, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, celebrating 50 years of serving individuals and businesses in North Dakota, offering personal and business banking, mortgage, insurance, and investments, and striving to take their customers and communities farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 22nd. On this date, in 1904, the Oaks Republican newspaper noted that North Dakota would be proudly taking part in the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, better known as the St. Louis World's Fair. The fair sprawled across 657 acres at a cost of $11 million. North Dakota opted not to have a building of its own. Instead, the state's $50,000 for the fair was split between exhibits in several buildings. The main exhibit was in the Palace of Agriculture. It featured the two-room cabin that Teddy Roosevelt lived in. It displayed his furniture, clothes, and mounted animal heads. Since Teddy was president at the time of the fair, his cabin was a big draw. He visited the fair and went to see it for himself. Also in the agriculture building were examples of every crop grown in the state, using the best samples collected in 1903. In the Palace of Mines and Metallurgy, North Dakota was represented by displays on items like coal, clay, and building stones. The Forestry, Fish, and Game Building featured the wild game of the state. North Dakota also participated in the Colonnade of States with a gigantic statue sculpted by artist Bruno L. Zim. So even though North Dakota did not have its own pavilion, the state was well represented. For 184 days, almost 20 million people attended the fair to be entertained and amazed. The fair showcased innovations and inventions. Electricity was a modern marvel, and the Wright brothers, who had made their successful first flight only the year before, brought their Wright Flyer to the fair. Henry Ford was also at the fair, having established the Ford Motor Company the year before. While the hamburger and the ice cream cone were not created especially for the fair, the exposure to such a broad audience made them instantly popular. The fair inspired the song Meet Me in St. Louis, as well as the movie of the same name starring Judy Garland. And while the third Olympic Games were held in conjunction with the fair, they were largely overwhelmed by all the excitement over the fair itself. And finally, a couple of more North Dakota notes. The State Press Association made the fair its destination for their annual excursion. And two North Dakota politicians, Roger Allen and Frank White, won gold medals for exhibits of grain they grew. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Native American communities face high rates of domestic violence.
When I ask how many had either missing or murdered family members, I would say at least 40% of the room hands went up.
We'll examine how tribes are struggling to reduce violence. Also, the UK's Conservative Party announces their pick for a new prime minister on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, our Ashley Thornburg talks with the author of Three Women. Lisa Tadeo's book examines sexuality from the perspective of women from three small cities, including West Fargo. And we'll talk with organizer Jill Weiss about the upcoming Bluegrass Goes Pink concert in support of cancer awareness. It's coming up at Cross Ranch State Park. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.